Just wanted to say how pleased I am to be here. Thank Doug and the other conference organizers for inviting me. I have to say what Nancy just shared was really, really hard for me to hear, I'm sure for you as well. I actually started my career working as a child protection caseworker in New York City, found my way into research, and what I'm going to talk with you about today are data sources where we have lots of zeros on the end. And so sometimes what can be hard is that you lose sight with these large numbers that each number represents a unique child who's often experienced incredible trauma. So in some ways, kind of a challenging connection to what you presented. Just want to start by acknowledging colleagues at both Berkeley as well as the University of Southern California. Really excited about the network that's being formed here, because what we have in California is a very, very close university agency partnership, where for over a decade, researchers at UC Berkeley, led by Dr. Barbara Nidell, have partnered closely with the state so that all of the administrative data that's collected concerning children who are reported for abuse or neglect is analyzed, used for outcomes and accountability, and it's a really terrific longstanding collaboration, which has recently expanded down to USC where I am, so very excited about that. And want to acknowledge the terrific foundations and other funders who have supported not only the longstanding work at UC Berkeley, but the newer research that's been taking place at USC. So what do we know about child abuse and neglect? We know that in the US each year, 6 million children are reported as possible victims of abuse or neglect. About 3.5 million investigations take place, and around 700,000 children are substantiated as victims. In California, it's a little under 500,000 children. So again, lots of zeros. We have almost 10 million children in our state, and about 500,000 are reported for abuse or neglect each year. We also know that children 0 to 4, the first 5 years of life, before kindergarten, experience the highest rates of abuse and neglect, and are also at greatest risk of the most pronounced physical and other long-term consequences. But what we know, and was certainly underscored in the most recent Institutes of Medicine report that was recently released, is that our knowledge is very, very much still emerging. And one of the reasons that I think our knowledge is still emerging, and what our project is really hoping to do, is that a lot of the work that has been done has focused on kind of snapshots of children who are known to the child protection system, snapshots of victims. But that data in isolation tells us very little about what those children looked like before they had contact with the child protection system, what they looked like after they had contact, and it also doesn't provide that broader population-based context within which we can understand how these children and families may or may not differ from other children and families in our community, which is incredibly important in terms of developing preventive interventions that are strategic and that are targeted. And one of the reasons for that is we have a fundamental problem that our public sector has not yet been able to resolve. And it's in large part because confidentiality laws make it very, very challenging. So what we have currently are distinct systems, all of which engage with children and families, education, healthcare, child protection, early intervention, and they all collect data. But the data, by and large, sit in silos, not integrated with one another. Now, if you jump ahead to the future, I would hope that one day we are in a position where we have integrated information and data that can really inform our understanding of children's trajectories through systems over time, can inform how we allocate what unfortunately will always probably be a limited number of service slots and resources. But what's been interesting in my work with the state of California and with counties is that as a researcher in a university-based setting, I often have a much easier time accessing data from these different systems than do my colleagues within government. And in some ways, it makes a lot of sense. I'm able to very clearly outline that I would only be using these data for research and evaluation and surveillance purposes, whereas my colleagues in government need to talk about, well, would we be using it for case planning? How do we maintain the confidentiality? Were the data that were collected by a substance abuse agency, can those be used to inform how we deliver services or the decisions we make about a child and family involved with our child protection system? So what we've been doing at the Children's Data Network is partnering with our public sector agency partners, developing research agendas and research questions, and yet functioning as kind of a third-party entity where we are pulling together data from different administrative data sources, linking them, and then using those data for research and evaluation purposes. So what I'm going to talk with you about today are data that have been linked and allow us to develop and answer questions prospectively based on populations of children who were born in California. And I'm going to keep it pretty simple. We're going to start with birth, we're going to look at child protection involvement, and we're going to look at death as an endpoint. And all of this information about these children and families will be framed in the context of the broader population of children and families in California. Again, something that we often are unable to do with a lot of our research. So what is the story? The story from these data can be distilled into four key points and one fifth one that I wanted to tack on. First, the problem is big and bigger than I think we've historically realized. Two, the signal is real, and what I mean by that is there's often a question, well, if we know that child protective service systems only touch kind of the tip of the iceberg, not all maltreated children, is there also a lot of noise? Are a lot of these children not really at risk? And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about kind of my belief that the signal of being reported to child protective services is a very real one. We do very little, so unfortunately, we often will go out and investigate, not offer any formal services, hope that that vulnerable child and family will make their way to community-based services. And what happens is we miss an opportunity and we see those children again. And I believe that with a better use of data, we can be much more strategic. So big data is all kind of hot right now. From the perspective of Google and a lot of private sector organizations, what I will be talking to you about is certainly not big data by their definition. But I think that as a field, we've been slow to embrace some technological innovations that would allow us to make much better use of data we already collect concerning children and families. And then you'll have to wait to hear what my final note is. Okay, so the problem is big. One of the things we do, if you read child maltreatment, the kind of the annual report, what do we talk about? We talk about the count of children who were reported for abuse or neglect in a given year. We talk about the number of children who were substantiated. In other reports, we talk about how many children are either in foster care or entered foster care. But what we fail to appreciate is that what looks like small annual risks of experiencing a particular event or having contact with a particular service sector can actually add up to much higher cumulative rates. And from a public health standpoint, again, we're always fighting for resources. And so, unfortunately, when we think about the child protection system, often people will dismiss it as a system that touches a very small number of children, children in some other neighborhood belonging to some other family. And so what we've done is we've been able to follow children born in California just for the first 5 years of life, so from birth through age five, and we've said how many children touch the child protection system as alleged victims of abuse or neglect. Okay. So if we think about an annual snapshot in California, and I think this aligns pretty closely with most other states, we see that about 5% of all children are reported as possible victims of abuse or neglect. But when we follow children who were born over time in our state, we see that that dramatically understates the cumulative picture just before kindergarten. So before age five, we see that 15% of children born in California have been reported for abuse or neglect. And even that number fails to kind of allow us to see that there are actually kind of dramatic risk differences by different groups. So if we look at children who were born to teen mothers, we see that 1 out of 4 children born to a teen mother has been reported for abuse or neglect before age 5. And when we look at another variable that's available on the birth record, children who are missing paternity, we see that 33%, 1 out of every 3 children born without a father named on the birth record has been reported for abuse or neglect before the age of 5. We also see tremendous geographic differences. So this is a quick and dirty map of Los Angeles County. And what you can see, it's broken up into different service planning areas. And what I'm highlighting for you here are just the dramatic differences in terms of the cumulative percentage of children who have been reported before the age of 5. You can see in one area we have over 1 in 5, almost 22% of children reported, much lower rates in different areas. Again, being able to then map what kinds of services are available, really important. And I know that many of you, and I guess maybe not many of you, my sense is that the field is moving away from a narrow focus on just substantiation. We're realizing that that is an imperfect marker of whether a child has been abused or neglected. There's a lot of subjectivity to it. There are a lot of legal differences around whether or not you can substantiate cases. But even if you want to focus on substantiation as a meaningful indicator of abuse or neglect, what we see is that the cumulative percentage of children who've experienced substantiated abuse or neglect before age 5 and then actually through the end of childhood is much higher than we've previously realized. So about a little over 1% of children in California are substantiated as victims of abuse or neglect before age 5. If we look cumulatively at what that adds up to with a kind of cohort of children we follow from birth through age 17, we can see that by the end of childhood, 13% of children have been substantiated as victims of abuse or neglect. And this is based on a synthetic cohort analysis using some NCANS data conducted in collaboration with some colleagues from Yale. So what we've done is we have actual data we've linked using birth records through age 5, and then we've used these other methods to look and see what we would get if we follow these children out through age 17. Point 2, the signal is real. One of the things that I've often heard is the child protection system ends up picking up in its surveillance net a lot of children who are reported for abuse or neglect simply because they are living in poverty. Okay? It's hard to kind of dispute that, answer that. But one of the things that we have been able to do with these linked data is to look at fatality outcomes as kind of objective markers of clearly the absence of child well-being and also an indication of risk differences across groups. So what we've done is, and this is where we really do get to a tremendous number of zeros on the end, but when you're talking about two events that are relatively rare, the event of being involved with the child protection system and then the event of dying, you need very large numbers to do this. So what we've done is we've linked over 4.3 million birth records from the state to child protection records and to death records. And so if you look at this picture up here, what it allows us to do is to conduct a prospective analysis of CPS involvement and of death using retrospective data. And it allows us to effectively follow 4 groups. Children who were born in California, had no CPS contact, and did not die before age 5. Children who were born in the state had some kind of report to Child Protective Services and did not die. Children who were born never showed up on the CPS radar, but we see that they died before age 5. And then the last group, where they were born, there was a report to Child Protective Services, and we see that they died before age 5. We were able to use variables from the birth record, and I don't know about you guys, but I remember when I first started diving into birth record information, I had this vision of the birth certificate that I brought home for my 3 children, where, you know, we've got kind of the birth weight, my name, my husband's name. But there's actually a tremendous amount of medical and other information that is collected on birth records and which we have been using to attempt to do as much of, as researchers like to call it, an apples to apples comparison of risk that allows us to follow children and look at whether that report to CPS was an important and differentiating signal of a child's likelihood of death before age 5. And so these are some of the risk factors that we were able to include. What I would note is that while in many ways you would think that most of this stuff might already exist in the child protection data system itself, what it comes down to is most child protection data systems are used for case management purposes. So they're not rich sources of information such as what was the child's birth weight, was dad there at birth, what was mom's education. There are often fields for those data elements, but often they are not entered. Additionally, remember, this gives us information on every child who was born in California. So we were able to follow not only children who were known to CPS, but a bunch of other children who were sociodemographically similar based on these risk factors to children who were reported. Want to say just one other thing about death quickly. Often we pay attention to the child protection system when the press picks up a case of a child fatality. We were interested in death in this case not because we think that it's possible to prevent all child deaths, but again, because it's an important marker of differences across groups. And I always love to share this quote. An anthropologist, a mortality-based standard for evaluating parental behavior may be the closest we can get to culture-free definitions of neglect and abuse. So an implicit acknowledgement that obviously our definitions of what constitutes abuse and neglect over time have changed dramatically. But again, using death as a marker, I think, is a pretty good one. So what did we find? We looked at whether or not children who had been reported to Child Protective Services had a higher risk of injury death before age 5. We looked at kids regardless of whether there was an investigation. We didn't care if the report was substantiated. We wanted to look at the report to Child Protective Services as an early warning signal of a child and a family at a heightened risk or in a vulnerable situation. What did we find? So first, we looked at risk of injury death, and we ran survival models where what that means is we were basically following, the clock started when a child was born, and we followed them to age 5, and we had a variable that popped in when the child was reported to CPS. So we had a time-varying covariate that was entered at that point, and we had baseline risk factors for every single child that we were following based on the birth record information that I showed you before. And so what we found was that children who had a prior report of abuse or neglect died at a little over 2.5 times the rate of children who had never been reported after adjusting for all of these other risk factors which we know are associated with CPS involvement and are associated with injury fatalities. This is injury overall. We then looked specifically at unintentional or accidental injury deaths before age 5, keeping in mind that over 3/4 of young children who are reported to Child Protective Services are reported for reasons of neglect. So it certainly stands to reason that children who are reported for neglect may not be a classic case of an inflicted injury, but perhaps parental substance abuse is getting in the way of appropriate supervision or developmental kind of guidelines for the child. And what we see is that, again, after adjusting for all of these other risk factors, a prior report to CPS was associated with a rate of injury, of unintentional injury death that was twice as great. And finally, when we looked at intentional injury deaths or inflicted injuries, we see that it's over 5 times as great. And again, that's after adjusting for other risk factors. That's the summary picture. And want to just quickly also mention that we looked at injury deaths here. We've also done some other work where we've looked at sudden infant death syndrome and other sudden unexpected infant deaths during the first year of life. You can see here we have SIDS. So infants who have been reported to Child Protective Services and remained at home, we have a rate of SIDS that's 3 times greater than other children who have not been reported. And then we have here accidental suffocation in bed, undetermined death, and that's the overall kind of sudden and unexpected infant death. We've done some other work looking at other forms of kind of natural death and found a very kind of heightened risk. So again, my point here is that I am not saying that all children who are reported to Child Protective Services have been the victims of abuse and neglect, but clearly our child protection system serves as kind of that final safety net and a system that signals that we have a high-risk population of children. I'm going to skip that. Number three, we do very little. We looked here at a single birth cohort of children in California. So around 560,000 children were born in the state. And in the first year of life, about 5% of those infants were reported for abuse or neglect. So that's about 30,000 kids. A lot of kids, but 5% of an overall population feels like a population that we might or should be able to do something for. What we did is we looked at infants who remained at home after that early warning first report came in. And we found that 82% of infants remained in the home with their families. The others were removed and placed into foster care after that first report. But what we also found was that we provided some type of formal service through the child protection system to fewer than 10% of those infants who remained at home with their families after that first report. Now, unfortunately, I don't have data concerning what types of referrals may have been made to community-based organizations, but I can tell you that in terms of a formal kind of ongoing family maintenance, support services, a case being opened, it was fewer than 10% of these infants. So how many do we see are re-reported before the age of 5? Overall, we found that more than half of those infants were re-reported for a second allegation of abuse or neglect before entering kindergarten. So we knew about these children in the first year of life. We provided some kind of family maintenance service to about 10% of those we left at home, and over half were reported for a second allegation of abuse or neglect. And when we looked at whether or not the initial decision that was made by Child Protective Services was tied to the likelihood or the rate of a second report, so what we did here is we broke it out and we said, was that first report substantiated, and if it was substantiated, was a case open, were services offered or not? And then we also looked at, in California, we have two different forms of unsubstantiated abuse or neglect. One is called unfounded, meaning there really was not any evidence to substantiate this. The other is inconclusive, meaning there may be some suspicion on the part of the caseworker or the investigating worker, but we don't have enough to substantiate the case. And then we have that third bucket of reports that were evaluated out. So call comes into the hotline, someone screens it, but there's no actual investigation following that initial report. So what we did here is we looked to see, well, are there differences in rates of re-reporting? Because as Brett Drake would say, if unsubstantiated cases are mainly spawned of erroneous, false, or similarly unimportant situations, then we would expect them to differ radically in terms of future risk when compared with substantiated cases. And what you see is that even for the group of children where initially we screened it out, we didn't think there was anything going on, 54% of those evaluated out children came back to the system, and it increases all the way to 65% among those where, again, there was enough evidence that we substantiated, there was enough concern on the part of the caseworker that we did open that case for services, and we see that 65% of those children and families are re-reported. We can be more strategic. It all comes down to linear relationships, doesn't it? Sherry had a graph that I was like, wow, that looks almost like the graph I'm going to show you. One of the things that we've done, and I would describe this very much as kind of a back of the envelope type calculation and graph, is we use those birth record variables I showed you earlier And we kind of just put kids in a high-risk or low-risk group for seven of the variables that were most strongly correlated with later CPS involvement. Low birth weight, normal birth weight. Young mom, not young mom. Dad's there, dad's not there. Education, et cetera. And what we found was this very, very perfectly graded relationship between the number of risk factors that you could literally count up on the day a child was born and the likelihood that they would be reported to Child Protective Services before age five. We also calculated the predicted probability. So we found that for children who fell into the bucket of having seven or more risk factors present, 89% of those children, or there was a predicted probability of 0.89, compared with just 3% for children who had no risk factors present. Now, when I show this, sometimes people will say, well, that's easy, then let's just make sure that all kids who have seven risk factors present, we provide home visiting services to, or some other kind of intensive early intervention program, and that would be great, except that it was actually less than 1% of children who had seven or more risk factors present. And so where the challenge lies, and it's really more of a policy and kind of normative question, is where do you draw the line? Where do you say that the risk of later child welfare involvement is great enough that we are going to at least offer this family and give them prioritization for a slot in our early intervention program? And so what we've been trying to do after this initial back of the envelope attempt is to figure out, can we actually use birth records and birth information to develop reasonable predictive risk models that could be used to more strategically allocate services to children and families? And one of the things I want to note is, again, with administrative data, it's about a mile wide, right? We've got complete coverage, but it's about an inch deep. So the variables that we are throwing into these models, we are not attempting to establish causal relationships between the predictors we're putting in and the outcome we're looking at. Rather, we're thinking very pragmatically, and we're saying, listen, these are things we're already collecting in our data systems. We know that, again, paternity wasn't established. We think that that's a proxy variable for the likelihood that mom doesn't have great social support, that maybe there will be an unrelated male caretaker in the home in the next few years. But again, we don't have rich information as to what each of these variables means, so we are just looking at them for their predictive value. So I want to kind of point that out. We've played around with a bunch of different models. We've kind of built out the back of the envelope model that I talked about. We've taken the kitchen sink modeling approach, which is let's throw absolutely everything we can possibly harvest from our birth records into this model of ours. And then we've also tried the more kind of parsimonious or biggest bang for our buck. And while we're still kind of working to refine these, what we've gotten to so far is that if we think about mother families and infants falling into risk deciles based on those kind of predictors that I mentioned, and we look at the top 10% of kind of children who are born and fall in that top 10% of risk, what we see is that about half of them will be reported for abuse or neglect before age five. At the other end of the spectrum, we see that for children who fall in the lowest risk decile, it's about 1.4%. What do we do with this? That remains to be seen. We're working with, I'm working with some local county agencies in Southern California to think about how they can begin to integrate some of this information into some assessment tools that they use in the hospitals when they are attempting to refer families to home visiting and other early intervention programs. A huge blind spot for us right now is we don't know who's receiving what. So it could be that our nurses and doctors, that we are already naturally triaging the top 10% to services, and therefore a model such as this doesn't actually get us anywhere. But again, the key is that we actually don't know who's receiving our services so far. And so again, we've been using these data and we're now moving to integrate some home visiting and other early intervention data to try to figure out how are we doing with our case finding efforts. Are these services serving the families and children who are highest risk, or maybe in the middle of the distribution because perhaps those families are easier to engage? Okay. I know I'm tight on time, so my one final note, and this kind of is a nice segue to the afternoon session. I did want to just briefly share some work that we've been doing around breaking the cycle, because it's some work that I get really excited about in terms of what I think is some real potential here. And so one of the other things that we've been able to do with just, again, the birth and the child protection records that I mentioned to you and that I've been talking about, is we've been able to look at teen mothers who gave birth in 2006 or 2007. We've used the child protection data to construct a history of child welfare involvement for each of those mothers in the population overall. And then we've also used the child protection records to construct a history of subsequent child protection involvement for all the children who were born to those teen mothers. And so what that allows us to do is, again, from a population standpoint, really look at all teen mothers and the relationship between a history of CPS involvement and the likelihood that their child will end up involved in the system. And I always love it when I have a graph that does all the talking for me. So quite simply, let me just briefly orient you. Over here, we are looking at report to child protection as our outcome. And here we're looking at a substantiated report. And this is, again, before age 5, for children, and we will be breaking it out based on the history for the teen mothers. So what we see here are, these are children who are born to teen mothers where, when we looked back to mom's 10th birthday, which is as far as the data would allow us to go, we did not find any evidence that this teen mother had ever been reported for abuse or neglect. And so we can see that overall, around 18% of children born to those teen mothers are reported for abuse or neglect before age 5, and about 5% are substantiated as victims. We then looked at children who were born to teen mothers where there was an unsubstantiated report of abuse or neglect for the mother. And you can see dramatic differences. So almost 35% of children born to teen moms where the teen mom had some kind of history that was unsubstantiated with the system. And over here we see it's about 12%. And finally, when we looked at children who were born to teen mothers where the mother herself was a substantiated victim of abuse or neglect, you can see that we're talking about almost 45% of those young children being reported for abuse or neglect, and almost 20% substantiated as victims. So this is an article that will be forthcoming, but I did just want to share that with you. We were really surprised by the findings, because when you're talking about a high-risk subset of new moms, teen moms, you often, or I certainly was not expecting that we would find there to be such a differentiation on the part of the child's risk based on mom's own history, but we clearly found quite a striking one, which, again, in terms of targeted prevention efforts and scarce resources, we have these data already in our public systems. Okay, I'm gonna skip that. Okay, so what is the take-home message from me to you, hopefully? I'll just jump to the third bullet that I truly get really excited about the potential of making better and smarter use of our data that we already collect in our public systems. It is not going to be the answer. We certainly need richer explorations using survey and other data sources, but there's a whole lot here that I don't think we have properly mined, and I think there's a tremendous opportunity for universities and practitioners and clinicians to partner around the questions that are asked and the use of those data. And this is the website, the Children's Data Network. Our funding just started in December, so we are very new, but I hope you'll check it out. There are some projects that we're working on listed, and there's my contact information. So thank you.